Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is Anti-Fascism Then and Now, featuring anti-fascist activist Daryl Lamont Jenkins. Reading from Daryl's bio, born in Newark, New Jersey and raised in nearby Somerset, Daryl Lamont Jenkins was influenced by the civil rights movement as a young man. At 19, while serving in the military, Daryl saw an episode of the Oprah Winfrey Show on the subject of skinheads. That grew into a lifelong passion for documenting the hate politics of the right, and with the founding of One People's Project, his passion found a home. One People's Project has played an instrumental role in exposing and causing the collapse of hate groups throughout the U.S., and aims to form a larger community of activists dedicated to anti-fascist work. IDAVOX, the media outlet of One People's Project, issues up-to-date reports on hate groups from around the country. Daryl Lamont Jenkins was a consulting producer on the short film Skin, which won the 2019 Academy Award for Best Live Action Short. He spoke at Burning Books, a radical bookstore in Buffalo, New York, specializing in activism, social justice, and liberation struggles, on November 20, 2024. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
Normally, I don't really have notes or anything like that, but there's a lot of stuff that I wanted to talk about and I didn't want to miss it. So I'm going to start off talking from here at first, and then I'm just going to riff because I can riff. And I really didn't need to write this down, but I wanted to just say, first off, I want to thank Leslie and Burning Books for inviting me here to talk to all of you. We met at the Binghamton Anarchist Book Fair, and I was telling them that I need to just go out more and talk to people. And they helped facilitate me speaking over at Niagara University last night, and that was great. I really had a great conversation with folks. We could have gone on for hours, but time constraints. So in a couple of weeks, actually, I'm going to be on the road to Worthington, Ohio. I'm actually going to be speaking to some high school students. I've been speaking to this particular class for a number of years now via Zoom, and this is going to be the first time I'm actually going to be there in person in perfect timing because a neo-Nazi crew decided to march in Columbus, which is just down the road. I also used to live there, and while I was there, I was hooking up with Anti-Racist Action and really was able to just get some of my sea legs going. I infiltrated an anti-abortion crew who was protesting outside a clinic that my roommate was working at. And because I'm a Christian and I can follow along with what they're about, they had welcomed me in with open arms. And it was really interesting because I remember one time they had a whole meeting and there was a Father Frank Pavone that was going to be speaking at this meeting, and it was held at a cathedral, and I walked in. I didn't even get my foot through the door. This is how shameless they are. I didn't even get my foot through the door, and some woman came up to me and said, "We're so happy you're here." And I knew what was coming. "We were just asking, where were the African Americans in the pro-life movement?" I'm biting the insides of my cheeks because I just saw this coming. And I was just like, all right, I gotta be a spy, so I'll just shut up for now. And the worst about it, there was two things that were bad about it. One came later. The one that was immediate is that we found a cell of the Army of God when we did this infiltration, had dinner with them and everything at their homes, had Bible study. Army of God is an organization, it's a terrorist organization that believes in killing abortion providers and anyone in the LGBTQ community. And we found the crew of them and we put them on blast. And that's what we're gonna talk about when it comes to my work, because One People's Project, my organization, really ushered in the age of doxing. And it started with this crew. It started with this crew that I was dealing with in Columbus. And we've been around for about 25 years as of next year. And it has been indeed a labor of love for us. Has been indeed. And I just want to tell you, I'm especially happy to be here because it gives me an opportunity to talk to y'all, but most importantly, an opportunity to big up independent bookstores. I love this spot, and we seldom talk about it, but bookstores such as this have become a refuge for a lot of people. And these are important staples to any community they're in and a threat to the fascists that we deal with on a regular basis. That's why Red Ink in Providence was besieged by a group of neo-Nazis doing one of those little flash mobs things to come out and protest, and they did it twice because they recognize the threat that places like this have on them. And it's also why when you start talking about culture and building up a culture that they do not want you to build up, it's also why a fascist knucklehead attempted to attack a show down in Jersey that was to benefit my organization. He went to the show and tried to pepper spray people outside, tried to smoke bomb people outside, and ended up pepper spraying himself. So he's serving 8 years in jail because even though we don't call cops, the church that we was holding it in do. And that ended up in the news. I ended up having to explain to everybody on the news what Antifa was, and and he's sitting in jail for the next 8 years. And this is the thing that really bothers him. You're talking about a church. You're talking about a staple in the community even before we even get to us, because they're accommodating us because they know that we are going to take this society and this community further. And that's what they're looking for whenever they help us out and whenever they advance us, because they're not just helping us out. They are a part of this. It's not just us that's in the game. It's everybody. The people that are not here today, we're here for them in many respects. And that culture war that they always talked about, remember, you used to hear Pat Buchanan talk about a culture war all the time. Back in the 90s, he was talking worse than anything you probably heard at Madison Square Garden a couple of weeks ago. And that's the thing. The thing that they know most importantly about this culture war is that they're losing. And they know they're losing despite who gets into office, because we are the people who don't give a damn about elections. We couldn't care less who you vote for. We know what we have to do. And that's the thing. We were going to do what we were going to do regardless of who won. If you are anti-fascist and you notice fascism was rearing its head in whatever direction this election was going in, and particularly if you're going major party. So the things that we are going to be talking about today is what we are going to talk about anyway. And being that the theme of this talk is about fighting fascism then and now, I was so glad to come here where a lot of the fight against fascism was front and center for over 100 years or so. I went to the Underground Railroad Museum over in Niagara Falls. I never heard of this place. And I found out about it because I spoke at Niagara and I met Professor Saladin Allah, who is the director at the museum. And I was told he was a descendant of a conductor of the Underground Railroad, and that Harriet Beecher Stowe used him as an inspiration for her book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. I didn't catch a name when they told me this yesterday, and I didn't put two and two together. But then I go to the museum and found out that Professor Allah was a descendant of Josiah Henson. Now, he was more than just Underground Railroad. He was before Underground Railroad. He and his family fled slavery, liberated themselves by crossing over into Canada, and founded a settlement and a school for others that were also finding themselves liberated. He did that before the Underground Railroad was even thought of. And I really got to say, I love this museum. I was only there for maybe like an hour, and it was a very worthwhile hour. But it's not the only thing that you had here. And you had a strong abolitionist bent here in Buffalo, here in Niagara Falls, and there was a lot of hardcore fights in that regard. They liberated a lot of people back then. And there's one thing that's really interesting that I found out. Native son Millard Fillmore was responsible for the boon because when he signed the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850, that caused everybody to just run up into Canada. And he went on to be an anti-immigration activist, and he was working with Andrew Johnson in his Reconstruction efforts, which from Andrew Johnson's standpoint, he's a segregationist, didn't do anything for us. So Millard Fillmore, that was that dude, was that evil dude that whose work we're still trying to beat back, even to this day. And it's interesting because now here I am wearing a shirt with an Ida B. Wells quote. She was here in 1906. W.E.B. Du Bois had started something called the Niagara Movement, kind of like morphed into the NAACP. And he founded that in 1905. And she became a member in 1906, and she came up here to promote it. So you have a lot of history here. The Niagara Movement is actually supposed to have their initial meeting, initial conference here in Buffalo. But they was worried about the opposition that they was getting from Booker T. Washington's people. Booker T. Washington just considered them to be radicals and was getting in the way and was ruining everything. It was basically, the Niagara Movement was his Antifa. But in those days, they shot folks. So what they did was just simply go up across the river and had their conference in Fort Erie. And now, here we are today. Here we are, and we still have a nice little rich history of anti-fascism that we can still look at that is straight up identified, unlike back then, identified as fascism. If I wasn't wearing this shirt, I'd probably be wearing the shirt of Rugosh Bela, a.k.a. Bela Lugosi, because he was one of the first anti-fascists. He started one of the first anti-fascist organizations against Mussolini. And he was always hardcore like that. So I wear his shirt as kind of like a clandestine Antifa shirt. But that gives you an idea. We've always had this fight, whether you're talking about Cable Street in the UK, whether you're talking about dealing with the civil rights movement in the 60s, whether you're dealing with the McCarthy era. We've always had this fight. We always had those people who knew how to take these characters on. But let's talk about what we are doing now. Let's talk about what is more contemporary. Now, in the 80s, there is a book, I'm not sure if it's here, I think it is. It's called We Go Where They Go, The Story of Anti-Racist Action. Anti-Racist Action was an organization that was founded within the punk scene to basically chase the Nazis out. And they did much more than that. They was able to just identify the Nazis that they needed to go after. They started in 1989, and the rest, as they say, was history. Everything that they hate about Antifa, they basically set the standard for. That the fascists hate about Antifa, it's their fault. And I was a part of that for a little while. Columbus was a nice little stronghold, even though it was founded in Minneapolis. But there was other groups. We got to show love to folks in Greensboro, North Carolina, who was murdered by the Klan as they protested them. We can't forget about them. We cannot forget, absolutely cannot forget, the activity over a course of 5 to 10 years in Portland, Oregon, also in 1989, after Mulugeta Sarraw was murdered by members of Eastside White Pride. That sparked a huge war going back and forth where the Nazis saw one of their own getting taken out. I know people who were involved in that, and they don't brag about those actions. They rather it went a different way, and I don't blame them. I mean, it definitely takes a toll on you when you kill someone. Don't act like you're not going to have any remorse. No matter how bad the person is, you don't know how you're going to be when that happens, if that happens. And that's the deal, but they had to do what they had to do back then. But in this whole time, we also, when you look at 1999, we also lost two members of Anti-Racist Action in Las Vegas, Dan and Spit. And it took a while for justice to be meted out in that case. We've taken our shots, but we've also given some. I mean, we caused some whenever they tried to hold a public meeting in York, Pennsylvania, back in 2012. And that was when they was really coming out, after September 11th, really just coming out every month to just cause some damage to society since they think they had an opportunity. And York, PA, was a nice little parallel with Charlottesville because you basically had 400 Nazis on one side and 400 Antifa on the other. There was a lot of clashes, and yes, there was somebody who drove his truck into a crowd of people. I don't think the only reason why he served 2 years, nobody died, but I think he only served 2 years because one of those people he hit was a cop. I don't even think the 9-year-old girl mattered to anybody, but when he hit that cop, that's what he went to jail for. But that was the kind of thing that we was dealing with for years. For years, we was just anti-racist action, and One People's Project was basically just going all over the country. Any kind of Nazi rally or Klan rally that was happening within a 100-mile radius, we were there. Like the book says, we go where they go. And when I was younger, if I can double back to the 90s, I wasn't even in a group. I was with a crew of skins, traditional skins, who basically just had the mindset that if you see a Nazi in our town, they have to go. You might see a black and white picture of me wearing a black jacket with an upside inverted flag and a whole bunch of pins. That belonged to one of them at one time. And he lost it in a fight in the street with some of us. And I wrote a story about that's in a book that's edited by Shane Burley called No Pass It On. You can read the story if you can get the book. But that's the kind of thing that we was basically accustomed to. So the early 2000s, we was just all over the place trying to make sure that we keep these characters at bay. One People's Project started in 2000. Why? Because we did not see a lot of this activity going on in New Jersey and in the New York area. And then all of a sudden we started to. A white supremacist rally was about to happen in Morristown, New Jersey, and we organized around it using a website, identifying those that we thought that were going to be there. And people had never saw anyone put together a website to do that. And after the rally in 2000, July 4th, 2000, we just kept it going. That's why I'm here today. We just kept it going. We just started identifying not just neo-Nazis, not just Klan, but also just people in the far right, folks that are in the mainstream. Our whole initial mission was to show how this kind of thing was connected to the mainstream of conservatism. Because as I said before, Pat Buchanan was a part of this. Pat Buchanan was mainstream. All of this nonsense. Now, enter a group called the Council of Conservative Citizens, and their board members, one of their board members, Jared Taylor, who started a newsletter called American Renaissance and held biannual conferences. His whole thing was to bring that brand of politics, that brand of fascism, into the Beltway. The Council of Conservative Citizens used to have all kinds of elected officials from the right come and speak. And we're talking about folks like Trent Lott. Trent Lott got in trouble because he was an honorary member of the Council of Conservative Citizens. Council of Conservative Citizens was something that morphed out of the white citizens' councils of the 60s. You know that whole thing about Abbott and DeSantis busing migrants up to Martha's Vineyard and all that? That actually started with the white citizens' councils telling black families there's jobs up in Martha's Vineyard. They did that first. So that's the legacy that we were dealing with when the Council of Conservative Citizens came rolling along. But like I said, they had biannual conferences, and they were even shown on C-SPAN. You can even still find the old videos of the Council of Conservative Citizens and American Renaissance on C-SPAN where they talk about mass deportation. It seems like everything just coming around today. Because I'll tell you, when the Minutemen came along in 2005 and really started pushing the whole anti-immigration thing, and they was basically patrolling the borders and all of that, that gave them an opportunity to basically say, okay, this is our time, we must seize it. Remember, here's something important. When you look at the Minutemen, there's a reason why back in the day I called it the Minuteman Project, because David Duke did that for his Klan border patrols in the 70s.
You are listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Anti-Fascism Then and Now, featuring anti-fascist activist Daryl Lamont Jenkins. He spoke at Burning Books in Buffalo, New York on November 20th, 2024.
If you remember anything about the Minutemen, they was a group of anti-immigration activists, or rather anti-immigration knuckleheads, that would basically patrol the border. And that's what the Klan did in the 1970s. So they was basically living that kind of life. And ever since 2005, they just simply would not let go of the kind of good life they tasted once they started seeing the mainstream of right wing basically embrace them. And then 2008 happened, and Barack Obama became president. Now, regardless of how you may feel about Barack Obama, a black man being elected president of the United States made them all just short circuit. They were the generation that made that happen, that allowed that to happen. They didn't know what to do, which is why we have Trump today. Because if you look at Trump, and I made this point yesterday, he is everything they have always said a president should not be, right? But it doesn't matter, because it's all a part of what they want to do, what they've always wanted to do. He's just an avenue. He's just a means to an end. One thing that Donald Trump has done would have ended everybody else's career, but it's different now. It's very different now, because they don't know how to keep us from advancing. And this is the best chance they feel that they have to do that. If Trump is this popular with the folks that we're trying to reach, then we're going to support Trump. That's just the attitude that they have. I mean, Project 2025, we talked about it all year. I've been talking about it all my life, because Heritage Foundation has been pushing it ever since they founded it. All these right-wing think tanks have been pushing just that thing. And I mean, you take a look at PKSF, the guy who they're nominating. They say that they're nominating to be the Secretary of Defense. I first came across him when he was trying to promote the idea of rewriting the Constitution, getting a convention of the states, which hasn't been done since the 1700s, and get everybody together to just basically rewrite the Constitution so that the left doesn't have as much say in it, as much advantages in it as we do today. So that's the kind of guy that they want as Secretary of Defense, but it's also something that predates anything that Trump was doing. They've been pushing for this for years. So it isn't about Trump. It isn't even about Project 2025. It's about them, and it's always been about them. But we got this. We got this. Because the truth of the matter is, you have to pay attention to who it is that they hate the most, and who scares them the most. And that is us, the folks in this room, because we're looking at them. And when we look at them, we do not like what we see. And when we do not like what we see, we do something about that. Dennis Prager, the radio talk host that now has a so-called university, he wrote a column a couple of years ago. First, he's one of those folks that like to predict civil war in this country. But he once wrote an article, an op-ed piece, calling for liberals to join with conservatives so that they can beat their common enemy, the left. So I found it really interesting when I saw Bill Maher in one of his ads. Man, Bill Maher has been a problem for me for a very long time. I mean, he is so bad, the Islamophobia that he is known for is benign compared to what he's been about lately. I mean, last year around this time, he did one of his little new rules and all of this, where he went on a rant about Western civilization. This is another thing I talked about last night. And if you ever hear the term Western civilization, it means white supremacy. There was a group called Youth for Western Civilization. It was put together by a guy who spoke at a white supremacist conference this weekend. We're going to get to that conference. That's the American Renaissance Conference I mentioned earlier. And when he went on his rant, when Maher went on his rant on Western civilization, it was in defense of Israel and all of that, because he considered Israel to be an outpost for the West in the Middle East. You don't need an outpost for Western civilization in the Middle East. There's only two reasons why you need an outpost: when you're trading and when you're at war. And there's no trading going on in Gaza. There's no trading going on with the Middle East. And then you hear him run off at the face, and he makes it clear, and this is on YouTube if you can find it, he makes it clear that he is not talking about black culture or Latino culture or Asian culture. He's talking about white people. He doesn't say white people, except to say, yeah, and you hear the left always just complain. If they hear Western civilization, it just means white man bad to them. Okay. Okay. It just means white man to you, sure, but you're not going to say that because you know that we'll come for you for that. But that's, Western civilization is just another code word. And when I heard him say that, I'm sitting there listening to him as he talks going, everything he says is something I heard Richard Spencer say, almost word for word. And it gives you an idea of what it is and who it is we are dealing with. When you see Bill Maher, you're looking at white supremacy on HBO. And if he wants to pick a fight with me on over it, and he won't, I'll be more than happy to engage. So this is the kind of thing that's, that we have to be mindful of. And this is one of the reasons why I'm here today. Because fighting fascism today is a little bit more not concealed, but rather more, I guess, I don't want to even say accepted. I think because they can hide behind Trump and hide behind some of the people that Trump had uplifted, a lot is basically being allowed. I think our mission is to make sure that they know otherwise. First of all, one of the things that we need to do is not wait. And like I said, I know we don't wait for elections, but we have to encourage communities to start being proactive right now. And don't worry about who wins the next election. Don't worry about the midterms. Democrats are going to lose it in 2 years. The Senate is not promising in 2 years. So whatever it is we're trying to get back, we're not going to get back that way. 4 years from now, who knows what's going to happen? Who knows? And then there's the wild card of Trump might not even be in office that long. We don't know how he is going to fare over the next 4 years. He might get kicked out. He might pass away. But the bottom line is it won't matter because we have work to do. We have to figure out what direction we are going to go in. And that brings me to why I even started with the whole thing about the bookstores and how we should support them. And we have to start building up our own institutions. We have to go beyond the political process. People, that's what Occupy was about. Occupy was about trying to figure out how to address our concerns and our needs away from a corrupt political system. We can't, I mean, that's another thing that really pissed me off about Bill Maher back in the day. When all the Occupy encampments got shut down, he went on TV to say, now is the time for us to get out of the tents and start canvassing for Democratic candidates. And he called it a new rule. And I said, that's not the new rule. That's the same old And it's a sign that, well, I think he intentionally didn't get it because he really didn't have anybody from Occupy on the show. He had the Tea Party on the show all day long. But Occupy, I think it only happened once. But that's okay. We have our own media. We can talk for ourselves. And the thing about Occupy that was really important is that not only did it encourage people to establish something apart from the mainstream, apart from the contemporary, but it also started identifying who the real problem people were. And we really didn't even say the politicians were the problem people. We said the banks. The banks are what fuels this corrupt political system that we're trying to fight. The banks fuel a lot of things that we're trying to fight. And we focused on them, pointed out that we are the 99%, they are the 1%, and we are against anything that they are foisting upon us, and we gotta fight it. And we cannot fight it in the contemporary way. Of course, the Tea Party crowd came up with this nonsense about how we are the 53%, i.e., we are the ones that pay the taxes in this country, and you don't. It's like, oh, come on, man. You definitely missed the point on that, especially when you consider that military people also don't pay federal taxes either. You want to argue with them? But that's neither here nor there. I mean, my attitude about Occupy is that we did, in fact, start something, and we have to maintain, and I'll tell you why. Minimum wage is still at $7. When we were fighting for 15 before the Democrats thought it was a good slogan. I mean, they chased us off these, they shut down all of our encampments because we were fighting for a raised minimum wage. And then they started with this thing called Fight for 15 when they didn't really have to fight. All they had to do was implement it. And when they had the opportunity a few years back to make it happen, it was one of them that shut it down, Christian Cinema, with a curtsy. Which is one of the reasons why we say you cannot rely on the political process. They're not your friends. I mean, I don't know how many times we have to make that point, but that we'll keep making it, we'll keep reinforcing it, but most importantly, we will keep producing. And I think that's really what matters. Talk is cheap. Talk is cheap. It's good to read, good to learn, good to talk amongst ourselves. But then, at some point, we have to go out and do what we think needs to be done. That means if we have food ghettos, we have to start building up places that where people can get food. If they're going to abolish the Department of Education, then I guarantee in about 4 years, it will still be there. Department of Education will still be there. But they're threatening it. If they're going to go after education in general and tell us what we can teach, especially black people, then it's like we got our own schools. In fact, one of our members, Beth Foster, has a thing out in rural Kentucky called the Foster Woods School. She started that up and it's been doing good. She has a school that's going to talk progressive politics, and progressive is being benign when it comes to Beth. It's probably underscoring the fact, but the truth of the matter is she's setting this up so we don't have to rely on whatever Ron DeSantis says should happen. And she's in Kentucky, so luckily they have a governor that's not going to get in the way, but there's only a matter of time before somebody gets there that will try to. We also have to build our defenses up. And when I say defenses, you're talking about people who keep calling for a civil war. You're talking about Proud Boys that are going to be pardoned by Trump next year, that are going to be back in the streets trying to cause some havoc. I'm in Buffalo, and I was worried about what family members I might have lost at that grocery store, because they went to that grocery store on a regular. And to that dude whose name I don't remember, don't need to remember it, but I read his manifesto, and he said that he was doing it because of the criminal element that is in the black community, but no one he killed was a part of that. Not that it would have been better, but the fact that it didn't matter. These were folks that were contributing to their communities, that were taking care of their families, and he killed them just because he saw black skin. So just understand, in case you haven't picked up on it, that whole thing about going after black people because we're a criminal element is just a lie and just a dodge to just justify their BS. And you know that's the case whenever they try to tell us that we can't even teach our own history and calling it CRT. Ironically, critical race theory is about studying how they use racism to advance their institutions. And when you're telling us that your schools will not teach history that incorporates the accomplishments of people of color and others, yeah, that's what critical race theory addresses, and you pretty much prove the theory every time you do that crap. Knowing that is one thing. Stopping them is another, and that's the thing that we gotta do. But we don't have to wait until we win that war. We can still, as I said, build up our own schools, make sure that whatever's missing in our curriculums, we fill in the gaps. My parents did that. They had me reading when I was 2 years old. I started recognizing shapes and words when I was 2 years old. Did that to all of us kids. Now I'm a writer. But it's funny because education was pretty much the family business, because they recognized how important education would be, which is why I also have to add this. There's a lot of people on TV right now, especially from the right, and yes, Bill Maher too, who are trying to tell communities that they don't have to go to college. College education is not important. You can make tons of money as a plumber or as an auto mechanic, which is fine, which is cool. You can tell people that I don't have a problem with it until you tell them that you don't have to go to school. When you start focusing on who is being educated and why they don't have to be. You're not an ally, you're not a friend, you're not helping anybody, especially since you have a college degree. And everybody that pushes that BS has a college degree. So if the educated is trying to tell you to be uneducated, that should be a red flag. Who said I love the uneducated? Didn't Trump say that? And let's bring it back to him for a minute. And remember, I'm always going to say it's bigger than Trump. And here's why. The original definition of fascism, Mussolini said this, was the merger of the corporate with the state. Our biggest problem these days has been Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Charlie Kirk, who has never worked a day in his life, but can somehow lecture us because Foster Freeze gave him a couple of $1,000 to start Turning Point USA, and Donald Trump, all billionaires, all people who Mussolini was talking about. I'm doing a video about Marconi, and I'm calling him the first tech bro for a reason. He was the person who basically invented radio. He was the one that basically patented the first transmitters and responsible for a lot of the technology that we have today. He was a fascist, which is why I'm doing the video. He was in Mussolini's party. He supported the persecution of Jews in Germany. He died in 1935 or 37 or something like that. So he wasn't able to see the fruits of that labor. There was an institution that he ran that he would not allow Jews to be a part of, Jewish scientists to be a part of in Italy. He supported the invasion of Ethiopia under Haile Selassie, and actually has a, there's a movie theater, it's called the National Theater in Ethiopia. It used to be called the Haile Selassie Theater, but before that, it was called Cinema Marconi because it was built by the fascists when they took over Ethiopia. I write about him because he was one of the corporatists that Mussolini worked with. And we see the same kind of thing today. And be careful when people talk about Tesla. Tesla is another tech bro, and he operated in Jersey in a town that I work in called Rahway. And yeah, he went back and forth with Marconi on things about us, particularly who has credit for inventing radio. But even he was a problem. He promoted eugenics. He believed that humanity should stop pursuing democracy. So I say in the video, tech bros are going to tech bro. Because that's basically what we see in that. That's an early version of what Elon Musk is today. What Peter Thiel is today, the guy who gave us PayPal.
You are listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Anti-Fascism Then and Now, featuring anti-fascist activist Daryl Lamont Jenkins. He spoke at Burning Books in Buffalo, New York on November 20th, 2024.
Reason why I wanted to have this conversation today is that I wanted to hear from everybody. I think it's about time we get into the footing where we do, in fact, build up our own institutions that will counter anything that they have coming our way. And I said earlier, and I went off the rails with it, but the whole thing about defense is going to be real important, especially if the whole thing about the mass deportations happen. Because we are going to have to protect people who are going to be, it's basically the fugitive slave law all over again. We don't know how bad it's going to be or if it's going to be bad. It's going to be bad for the folks that are unjustly deported. And I think it's going to be real important that we are there to keep that from happening at all costs. And then there's the other issues that we have to deal with. The fact that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Nancy Mace is going to go after the first transgender woman in Congress, passing legislation directed just towards her because she might want to go to the bathroom at some point. First of all, that whole bathroom thing has got to be the pettiest thing that I have ever seen in politics. It's right up there with incels, but that's another, incels are another animal altogether. But when it started, I'm sitting there going, it ain't the first time they made a big deal about who goes into what bathroom, because civil rights movement was built around stopping that nonsense. But to come up with legislation for one person says a lot about how dysfunctional that crowd is. And we have got to exploit that dysfunction at some point, somehow, so that they do not cause us any other harm beyond what they're doing now. How do we do that? That's all depends on how active we are going to be. I said that one of the scariest things to them is us being proactive against them. And the more proactive we are, I mean, that whole line that the Harris campaign said, that when we fight, we win, they didn't fight. They didn't fight. We fight. And we do win when we fight. But here's the other thing that I really got to add. Stop waiting for people to die. Now, that is on us. That is on us. I mean, Charlottesville, everybody started saying, okay, we got to do something about this element because Heather Heyer was killed. But there was a whole bunch of other things that was going on leading up to what happened in Charlottesville. And basically, we was all like, okay, I'm glad to see that you're shutting down websites that you could have shut down 6 months ago. But it's kind of like a we told you so moment. January 6th was why aren't you listening? And the thing that really irks me about January 6th is that you had, after the election, the liberals who were going to try to play that game that they used to play back in the day where we can ignore them now. They're not going to cause any harm to anybody because we beat them, let them vent, just pay no attention to them. They were tearing down murals for Black Lives Matter. They were tearing down the posters that you have for people who were killed by the police. And the folks who were at the Black Lives Matter Plaza was like, where's all our allies? What happened? We said, well, the election's over and Trump lost. That was also when Proud Boys started stabbing people. That November was when Proud Boys started stabbing people. Then December 12th happened, and then we tried to come out a little bit more. That was the day where Enrique Tarrio and a few friends decided to go to Frederick Douglass Church, take down the Black Lives Matter banner that was on the church and set it on fire. They also tried to stab people there, but this time we stabbed them back. So we were listening. Then January 6th happened, and it was just like a massive thing for the liberals to say, stay away, let them vent, and all of this nonsense. And I was like, no, we got to be out there. But everybody agreed that we needed to stay away, everybody except me. The only reason why I didn't go is because I had an eye doctor appointment that I forgot about. I got home, and I saw them ending the count on C-SPAN, and I was like, oh, boy, was it a protest? They're getting loud, and they got to shut down. And then when I saw what happened, I was just like, I should have been there. We should have been there. And people to this day says, well, I'm glad you weren't, because you would have been a part of all of that. I says, it wouldn't have happened if we were there. And I know this because on July 6, 2019, Antifa was out there when Proud Boys wanted to hold a rally, and we kept their asses on Freedom Plaza. They did not go anywhere because we were there ready to play. If we had that attitude on January 6th, we would not see what went down. And I will tell you this too. If you want to listen to them try to tell people that Antifa was there, I says, no, if Antifa was there, if Antifa stormed that Capitol, we would still be there. Because we know what would have happened if we had gotten out. We would have said, look, we're going to have to make this count. It didn't count for them. So, I mean, even if they're going to get pardoned, even if they was able to do some propaganda stuff over the next 4 years or so, if we went into the Capitol, first of all, we wouldn't even allow to get that close. I mean, remember, Trump and his crew went after us in Lafayette Park when we were just sitting around. If we managed to get to the Capitol the way they got to the Capitol, one of us in this room probably would be president right now. So don't worry, I don't want the job. But that's the attitude we have to have. That's where we are today. Now we got to deal with Trump again. Now we got to deal with the sycophants thinking that they're going to be able to go further than they did the last time. And we have to remind them, no, that ain't happening. That ain't happening. We don't want it to happen. And they're all those, yeah, but you only had like 74 million people that didn't vote for Kamala, or Kamala, as they will probably tell you. I says, yeah, but that's 74 million And there's a whole bunch more, three times that much, that didn't vote, period, because they didn't think that it was worth it to. You know what is worth it for them? If you go into the neighborhoods and say, we're going to uproot it, then we'll handle you. So our mission is to start launching preemptive strikes and make sure that we don't even have to get that far. People need to be secure. We all need to be able to live that life that we all work for. And that's the important thing to remember. We're out there fighting for our lives and the lives of others. And we enjoy those lives and we want to keep enjoying those lives. We're not going to let this crowd take us down. They have never taken us down before. They just annoyed us for a couple of years. But that has to be the attitude that we all have. And that's all I can say for right now. And again, it's all right. We're going to be fine. We've always been fine because we know how to fight and they don't. We can't be elitist about this neither. I mean, we have to be real about the fact that this is not just about us in this room. It's about a lot of people who can't be in this room, who want to fight, who don't know how to fight, who don't even know that they need to. But they do know that they need to secure their lives. When I was a kid, I was straight up nerd. I mean, my parents saw to it. My father, I was born in Newark, which can be a hard town, so hard, in fact, that when my father came home from the hospital the day I was born, he went to take a nap. As soon as his head hit the pillow, a bullet went right through the wall. It was a couple that was shooting at each other with rifles. So he packed up everything in a little Toyota and moved down to the suburbs, came back to the hospital. Hi, honey, we moved. And I grew up in Somerset, New Jersey, and I was able to grow up the way that my parents wanted me to grow up. And that's why I became a bookworm and growing up. And it was always funny because I always tell the story about, I used to read a lot when I was a kid about Martin Luther King and Black history and the Civil Rights Movement and all of that. And I was always wondering, well, what happened to the Klan after I was born? Remember, I was born in 1968, the year that Martin Luther King was murdered. So I was like, well, what happened after 1968? How come I don't see that anymore? Because I didn't think that everybody just said, okay, fine. We'll take off the sheets and stuff. And, you know, I found out because our little weekly readers actually had an article about the Klan. This guy named Bill Wilkinson, who was the Grand Dragon at the time, the big guy in the 70s. And I was like, okay, so this is going on still. I'm 10 and I want to start monitoring these guys. So that's when I start waiting for TV shows that will have like Tom Mesker, another Klan leader at the time, and David Duke and all of them. And then I was in the Air Force and they started talking about skinheads. By the way, when I say skinheads, I don't mean Nazis. Skinhead culture is separate from Nazi culture. So we're just going to make that clear right now. But back then, I didn't know that. I watched Oprah, had him on the show, and I was like, okay, I don't know what this crowd is, but I see Tom Mesker in the audience. I'm going to have to keep an eye on this. And I started videotaping and archiving all the shows that they would be on. And then Geraldo came on, and then that infamous fight happened, so I documented that. And then I started listening to talk radio because I started hearing them say the same thing that those Klans and white supremacist groups started saying. I was like, okay, I'm going to start recording these shows. So I started listening to people like Bob Grant, who gets a shout out at that conference last weekend. Bob Grant was a radio talk host from back in the day who used to be downright nasty. He used to call Martin Luther King Jr. a bum, said that indigenous people should be lucky we let them survive. He hoped that George Halliday, who took Rodney King's video, gets what's coming to him. I mean, he was a mess, and I got all these still on tape. Matter of fact, I have them MP3'd on our website, one of our websites. So I started listening to talk radio. Then I started infiltrating their conferences, especially the anti-abortion conferences. Started going to this thing called CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference in D.C., because that's where they all showed up. So, yeah, I've been doing this for a very long time. Well, first and foremost, I would strongly suggest that when you are talking about defense, remember, it is defense. You do not want to
you do not want to engage first. You don't want to draw that first blood because that just puts you in a position where they can come at you and just basically ruin everything about you and everything around you. You want to be careful how you engage. I guess that's the best way to put it. You want to be careful how you engage. You got to be prepared for that. You have to be prepared for that. I am always strapped up when I'm not here in New York where I can't be because I have to be prepared. I am on a few kill lists right now. So, and I did tell you about the whole thing that happened at the church during one of our shows. It was a hardcore show, no less. This guy actually thought he was going to attack a hardcore show by himself. And he ended up pepper spraying himself, so he became, so it was, made no difference anyway. But yeah, you just have to be mindful that you might have to engage that way, but got to be smart about it. All right, I want to thank everybody for your time. I'm glad I came out here, y'all. I'm glad to see everybody here. Thank you. Peace out.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was Anti-Fascism Then and Now, featuring anti-fascist activist Daryl Lamont Jenkins. He spoke at Burning Books in Buffalo, New York on November 20th, 2024. We'll close with a short piece from Caitlin Johnstone, read by Tim Foley, called Where Does the Aggression Really Begin? Thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.
Where does the aggression really begin? New York prosecutors have charged Luigi Mangione with murder as an act of terrorism in his alleged shooting of health insurance CEO Brian Thompson earlier this month. This news comes out at the same time as a Haaretz report titled No Civilians, Everyone's a Terrorist. IDF soldiers expose arbitrary killings and rampant lawlessness in Gaza's Netzarim corridor. The report contains testimony from Israeli troops that civilians are being murdered in Gaza and are then being retroactively designated as terrorists to justify their execution. A recently discharged officer told Haaretz, "We're killing civilians there who are then counted as terrorists." These stories together say so much about the way the label terrorist is used under the U.S. centralized power umbrella. The guy who shot the health insurance CEO is a terrorist, but the people systematically slaughtering civilians in Gaza are not terrorists. The people who are fighting against those who are slaughtering the civilians are terrorists, and non-combatants are being categorized as belonging to this terrorist organization in order to justify killing them. Meanwhile, the Al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria were terrorists, but now they're a U.S. puppet regime, so soon they won't be terrorists. But they need to be designated terrorists for a little while longer because the claim that Syria is crawling with terrorists is Israel's justification for its recent land grabs there. The Uyghur militant group ETIM used to be a terrorist group, but now they're not a terrorist group because they can be used to help carve up Syria and maybe fight China later on. The IRGC is a military wing of a sovereign nation, but it counts as a terrorist group because of vibes or something. Is that clear enough? Really, the label terrorist is nothing more than a tool of imperial narrative control which gets moved around based on whether or not someone's use of violence is deemed legitimate by the managers of the empire. Because Mangione's alleged crime has ignited a public interest in class warfare, the label terrorism is being used to frame it as an especially heinous act of evil against an innocent member of the public. The Empire's favorite trick is to begin the historical record at the moment its enemies retaliate against its abuses. Oh no, a health insurance CEO was victimized by an evil act of terrorism. Oh no, Israel was just innocently minding its own business when it was viciously attacked by Hamas. Oh no, Iran attacked Israel completely out of the blue, and now Israel must retaliate. Oh no, Russia just launched an entirely unprovoked war on Ukraine. Everything that led up to the unauthorized act of violence is erased from the record because all of the violence, provocation, and abuse which gave rise to the unauthorized act of violence were authorized by the empire. authorized aggression doesn't count as aggression. Whoever controls the narrative controls the world. If you control the narrative, you can control not only when the historical record of violence begins, but what kinds of violence qualify as violence. Killing people by depriving them of health care because denying health care services is how your company increases its profit margins? That's not violence. Inflicting tyranny and abuse upon a deliberately marginalized ethnic group in an apartheid state? That's not violence. Violence is when you respond to those forceful aggressions with forceful aggressions of your own. If we are to become a healthy society, we're going to have to stop allowing some forms of violence, aggression, and abuse to be redacted from the official records while others are listed and condemned. Those who care about truth and justice account for all forms of violence, aggression, and abuse, not only those which inconvenience the rich and powerful. It is an act of aggression to do things which sicken and impoverish others in order to advance your own wealth. It is an act of aggression to pollute the biosphere we all depend on for survival in order to increase your profit margins. It is an act of aggression to use your wealth to manipulate your nation's politics in ways which exacerbate inequality and injustice. It is an act of aggression to maintain an apartheid state which cannot exist without nonstop violence. It is an act of aggression to surround the earth with military bases and encircle nations which disobey your dictates. It is an act of aggression to try to rule the world using military violence, proxy conflicts, staged coups, threats, starvation sanctions, and financial and economic coercion. These are all acts of aggression, and any retaliation against them will never be an unprovoked attack. As we move into the future, while these abuses exacerbate, it's going to become very important to maintain an acute awareness of this.